me, it seems like it works. Maybe that doesn't from where they are. And then the other part is, from our standpoint, you know, how that may or may not work. And, you know, at this moment, I just want to kind of put out there that, that I think we should consider, you know, at least think about whether it's an option.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And in our efforts to get a new back office, one of the big considerations is what we can do with fleet accounts, to set them apart, to make them unique, to service them differently, and to make available online a level of self-service that does not exist, and that really is not possible today. And you're right, the reassignment is a huge one. Really just uploading their plates. Most of these organizations keep their own Excel files of all the different license plates they have on all their different vehicles, but we don't have a great way to upload those. They have to go in and put them in manually, and that's a huge burden on them. And for the last, for over a year, we've been working with our existing technology to see if we can develop an upload from Excel for plates. And we've made progress, but not to the point of closure, which we had hoped. Somewhat complex programming in our existing system. But we continue to push at that, just in hopes that we can make it work. And that would be an example of a future pilot. If we could get, even in our current system, we can do a plate upload, a license plate upload from Excel, we could at least pilot it with a handful of companies, see how people feel about it, what their experiences are, and use that to inform how we actually program the new system.
Great. Going along with the roundtable discussions, we will be doing toll industry benchmarking, researching to see if other customers, fleet-specific customer units, or special fleet policies exist at other toll agencies around the country. If they do exist, to what extent do their customers feel they're helpful? Do the agencies find them helpful? Along with that, also determine what fleet issues are experienced nationwide. Drivers coming through Illinois experience, they go through other toll agencies as well. See if there's any common nationwide problems. And then along the, on the reassignment issue, we want to determine from other toll agencies what type of, or how their process to reassign goes, what authorizations or documentation other toll agencies require to assign. And then use the, you know, find the best practices in the industry and use it to help create and implement future pilots.
Great. Any questions? All right, Tim. Next time we see you, expect all the answers.
All the answers. He has a lot riding on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
It's good seeing you again.
Good to see you. All right, let me click. Where do I click? Forward.
China is down.
Probably not. Maybe you can just connect.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
No, it's off.
It's off. There you are. Okay. I'll use it as we move forward.
Okay.
So now we're to a discussion that I know is of great interest to everybody because it's been in the newspapers recently, which is the toll session fee that Indiana charges for iPass customers on their road. So iPass customers, when they drive in Indiana, pay all the tolls plus, for every single toll, 3 cents. And that reflects an agreement that was an E-ZPass group agreement when Indiana first joined E-ZPass, saying that because Indiana was a toll concession and a private company, that when they joined the E-ZPass group, E-ZPass members that were governmental could charge them a 3 cent fee for their drivers on other E-ZPass roads. And I think we could walk through the timeline if people are interested. This goes back to about 2006 when Indiana leased their roads out to Sentra, which also then later took over the Chicago Skyway and introduced electronic tolling and then joined the E-ZPass group in kind of due order. The I think we can get to the heart of the matter here in another slide. But in 2010, we estimated that about 60% of drivers on Sentra roads, Skyway, and Indiana roads are IPAS customers. And that those, because they're IPAS customers and we're holding their accounts and we're processing their credit cards and we're providing them customer service, we incur about a 6 cent cost for each of the transactions that an IPAS customer has on a Sentra road. And we charge Sentra 3 cents for each of those transactions. And then Sentra, somewhat recently, in 2011, chose to pass through that 3 cent charge to the to IPAS drivers. And I think what this really comes down to, and I think this is the heart of the matter, Sentra, when Sentra is seeing IPAS drivers on the road, they are avoiding an estimated $1.5 million in customer service costs because we're the customer service. That $1.5 million then divides roughly in half. $750,000 of it comes to the Illinois Tollway through that 3 cent fee, which they're passing on to IPAS customers, so it's really coming from IPAS customers. And we are absorbing the remaining $750,000. In the meantime, Sentra charges us for, let me make sure I get this correct.
Indiana.
There are Sentra drivers on Illinois roads. We have to pay 3 cents to Sentra, and that amounts to about $95,000 a year. So it's a complex issue, and we are researching what the legal parameters of it are, and we've kind of laid out some of the basic financial parameters, but we're very interested to hear what this committee has on its mind considering fairness and other such elements.
Director Towns, you want to?
I don't know what your thoughts are, but I'll go after if you've got anything to start us off.
It's a fairness issue. The question is, how do we make this fair to everybody?
I don't disagree with that at all. You know, and I think, Sean, you pointed out that this has been of kind of come to the forefront as a result of an article that was, I think, last month on the 19th in the paper. And, you know, there's some interesting information, assuming everything in the article is correct, but, you know, one of the things that Sentra seems to be doing in their pass-along is that they're the basis for them doing it is the fact that they did this multi-billion dollar evaluation of the profitability of operating a toll system, and somehow this interoperability cost is something that passed their evaluation, and so they didn't take it into consideration as part of the deal, and they're passing it along outside of the cost of the tolls. And clearly, based on what they're allowed to charge under the agreement, there seems to be some type of loophole that allows them to pass that along separate apart from the actual toll cost. You know, it's frustrating. Because we do have our customers that are, you know, showing these costs showing up, and you have people that question it, and they want to, you know, try to understand it. But in preparation for this and taking a look at it, and I guess one of the main questions that I have, if you take a look at their website, it appears that they've limited this collection effort to our drivers. Is that?
It does appear like that. We would have to reach out to them directly at the executive level to confirm that. But speaking to the people there who do day-to-day operations, reading their website, reading whatever literature we can find. It does appear that it's just Illinois.
And we've heard that, kind of that from other agencies as well.
We have. We've reached out to other agencies and asked if their drivers are getting charged in Indiana a toll differential like this, and the answer is no.
Well, I think from my standpoint, first and foremost, I think that we need to establish that information once and for all, whether or not that is indeed accurate. And I would, if nothing else, as we leave here today, I'd like to send that along and ask that we make that request to them to clarify that information.
Okay. A letter to the toll concession company requesting kind of a confirmation or clarification.
Correct.
Of that recent pass-through.
Then, David, my next point would be, whether or not that type of, pointed enforcement and separate policy for our customers versus anybody else that would potentially fall within that category outside of their system users, whether or not that's a legal standard in operation for them to apply. I don't need an answer right now.
I appreciate the question. Obviously, that's one of the operative ones that matters. And in this open setting, we're going to limit a little bit some of our legal analysis, which you'll obviously respect, and we may have some litigation or other legal issues to challenge or discuss about. But one thing I want to make sure you're focused on, and Shauna, you may want to add some comments, because I picked it up in your setup points, and that is, obviously, this exchange of the 3 cent, I'll call them administrative fees, that we work back and forth, in this case, Illinois, Indiana, but anybody, frankly, who's in any states in this EZ-Pass system, that does, in fact, come from the agreement that's over this whole group of tolling authorities, including Indiana's. So we agree the 3 cents is up to 3 cents, I believe it is actually, is going to be an administrative allowance that we can charge back one another. The fact that one of these agencies, Indiana here, is choosing to pass that along is in no way covered by the agreement that we talk. And so I just wanted, you referenced your phrase as loophole, et cetera, whatever we mean by it, just to make sure we understand kind of the document setup that we're dealing with, right? So it's that 3 cent comment being passed back and forth that does get lifted from the agreement. That's there.
Okay.
What somebody chooses to do afterwards, and as a result of being on the receiving end of those 3 cent administrative fees, Indiana's obviously made its decision.
And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that really as Cintra deals with this, they have two separate, there's two overriding legal documents. Number one, the EZ-Pass agreement that we've entered into that allows for Cintra and us to charge one another this 3 cent, but then they have, under their agreement and their lease of the roadway from Indiana, there are some certain caps on what they're allowed to charge as far as tolls. So this is where they've taken that and they say, we're going to charge X for tolls because that's what's allowed by Indiana. And then outside of that is this 3 cent, and rather than eating it, they're interpreting it as so they can just send it along to cut those costs.
It seems that way, that concept about where they get their authority, if you will, to pass some of that, I think is still one of our additional analysis pieces.
Well, thank you. And I guess as we do that, I think in that question of whether you can have these different policies for other, what appear to me to be similarly situated entities or drivers, that would obviously impact our ability as to what we can do moving forward. Because if Director Towns' comment, I think what's fair is fair. Well, if they're charging our drivers, perhaps we need to charge theirs, or we need to consider that. Until we do that first analysis, whether what they're doing is legal and right, that would impact whatever our options are moving forward, then as far as reciprocating that,
I would say there's certainly a logical connection there. I would say that in some ways, though, the concepts are mutually exclusive. They may decide
we may decide, whether we're deciding as a result of something they're doing or choosing to do something with our rights. One may follow from the other, or one may not. It may just be something we decide to look at, and I would suggest if we make the connection, you know, this authority may not necessarily want to be doing it totally tit for tat. It may just be one of the circumstances that's on the horizon that we're considering among many others.
Well, I guess my point is, if we wanted to take a specific approach to this, if that was going to be part of this, we have to still get over that same legal hurdle that we're going to be evaluating their policy on, because if we take the position that what they're doing is not legal, then obviously that would be the same. We would have the same evaluation as to what is an option for us as well.
Yeah, and as you'll appreciate, I know issues of standing to make certain claims may come into effect. Obviously, it's of no impact financially to the Illinois Tollway Authority. It's being incurred by an Illinois, or should I say, an I-Pass holding driver who's going on to the Indiana Authority.
If it makes you feel better, I'm an I-Pass holding driver who has driven through Indiana on the toll road.
Yeah, me too.
Okay.
And I didn't know about the 3 cents.
I'm sure my wife paid attention.
Are you out?
I'm sure mine didn't, and neither did I.
Once I read it in the paper, I did.
Yeah.
So. Do it to one, do it to all.
I don't know what other discussion points there may be at this point, but I think that is, I'd really like to find out that preliminary information and then get the update from you, David, before we can.
We will.
So to sum up, we're going to clarify with Indiana the exact terms of the 3 cents. Or who they're charging in terms of the 3 cent, and then also address some of the legal questions that we have here, and the legality of it, and any sort of actions that we might take as well.
And there are some additions, guys, that are not necessarily 3 cent related. The sort of seemingly tit for tat, you're dealing with 3 cents, so we should deal with 3 cents. There are other accommodations that we afford drivers who are not I-Pass holders, many of whom may come from Indiana. And things like that may need to be on the table for consideration.
Well, you know, as we do that, I think, you know, those are important things to evaluate. And let's take a look at all of those. So I think, you know, as the board wrestles with this, you know, be in position to lay all that stuff out, what these other, you know, the other considerations, what may be, and the options available to us and potential costs. I recognize, too, you know, the differences in what we're collecting versus what they seem to be benefiting off of is a significant, you know, I don't want to cut off my nose despite the face here, you know, just to get through this, I want to make sure that whatever we do makes sense in the overall impact of best serving our customers, so.
Well, we will we'll work through these points and come back to the committee so that we can talk about options and next steps.
Great.
That's very helpful direction. Thank you. So switching gears a little bit, the next item is a series of slides to talk a little bit about our electronic tolling technology and data contracts, and how we're imagining the future to unfold, because the sole source that we bring to you today is not probably going to be the only sole source you see from us in a long time. And we know that there is a deep desire, and we fully support it, to avoid sole sources. They are, you know, they are not as competitive, they don't bring as many vendors to the table. It's not what we want to do, it's what you sometimes have to do. We just want to talk through a little bit about that universe and then go ahead and bring our procurement item for consideration. So what we see up there has a lot of words, and I know it's not super fun, so let me just talk to it at a higher level, and then you'll see it again, but with some better points. So our technology and our data breaks down today into these three major boxes. One box is the lane stuff. I will just call it the lane stuff, technology that is in the lanes. And not just technology, but also services that maintain that technology and patents, because there are patents that we actually pay for right now that are lane-based, which is not only on the technology, but how the lane is laid out. Electronic tolling is kind of a new industry, and a lot of patents were submitted when all of this went into place. The next box is the kind of...
Sean, I'm sorry. When you say we pay for it, we pay for that as part of our costs.
We pay for it as part of our costs.
We don't own any of these.
Correct.
Okay.
But I'll talk a little bit later about why it matters that we pay from the vendors today, because if we were ever to go to other vendors, those patents are existing in how those lanes are laid out. And if we want to build new lanes or maintain existing lanes, it's not clear that we can necessarily just pay another vendor to deal with a patent that came with how we built it today.
Okay.
So the next box is the toll and IPass processing contracts. That's where we take transactions and we charge IPass accounts or we create violations. And you see two big bullet points. One is ETCC. That's the vendor that gave us our current system, that maintains our current system, and that we work with pretty much all day, every day, to make sure that we're capturing revenue and dealing with customers. IPass accounts, violations processing, and reciprocity, like we just talked about with Indiana. We are working, as everybody knows, to secure a new back office system that would do all of this as well, but in a more modern, flexible, expanded way, again, as we've discussed. And you'll see kind of that red bracket to the right that just says anticipated overlap. Because it's in a situation like this where you have so much data and it's relatively complex and you're looking to move kind of a light speed jump to a better technology, you typically have to run two systems at the same time for a little bit. You typically don't take all of your data and one day turn one off and turn the next on. There's usually some overlap. And then finally, the other contracts that you see in that bottom big box, those represent a ton of data exchanges. Our registered vehicle owner data we'll talk about today, the web services we get, the people who deal with our print and mail correspondence stuff, the retail distributor for inventory, which is Igor, the direct retailer of inventory, which is Jewel, collection agencies, our different payment processors, a lockbox contract that we'd like to have in the future, credit card updating, any skip tracing, you name it. This is data that's flowing in and out of our system as we try to find people and we try to provide customer service. So then the next slide talks a little bit, well, what are key procurement options? What are the typical things that we see in a procurement world? Because that is a lot to manage. Those are a lot of contracts, a lot of people at the table, a lot of vendors making all this happen. I've listed out the ones that are pretty familiar. John, you can jump in if I've missed anything. That's like really common. But small purchases wouldn't really apply to any of this. These are all too big. Competitive invitation to bid, which is an IFB. That's where you say these are the parameters, we'll take the lowest bid. A master contract where we try to leverage something probably from CMS usually. In fact, a master contract, I think, is what we ended up using for the American Express. When this committee looked for a way to reduce American Express charges, we found another contract in the state that we were able to work with to make that happen. I mean, that was a great example of where we could do that. Yeah. The state use program. We've talked a lot about that here because for a number of years, our customer service functions were in a consolidated contract with an organization called TransCorp, a very familiar tolling and transportation industry organization. And we've spent, at the direction of the board, almost 3 years now putting that, pulling it apart and putting it into state use vendors so that we can be more competitive and so that we can keep business in Illinois and with organizations that have missions that we support. So, you know, we work with Bridgeway, we work with Ada McKinley, we work with Printers Mark. Those were all things that used to be with Transport, and we are about to cut over in full to working with Lighthouse for the call center, another nonprofit organization. Competitive request for proposal. This is the most common. We just went through this and we talked to all of you within the last year about Igor, about Jewel. Those were typical RFPs. We're going through the last part of a competitive request for proposal that's considered professional and artistic, which has just a few different rules, but it's very much similar in other ways, and we're doing that for the new back office system. And then at the bottom, we have sole source, because it does exist and it does have to be leveraged sometimes, but it's always not always our first choice. Key sole source considerations. So when we find ourselves facing a possible sole source situation, we have to ask ourselves a few things before we can say, yes, this is worth bringing to a sole source. One is, do we have a plan to move beyond the sole source in the future? I mean, really, ideally, we should have a plan to move beyond it. You don't want to spend decades in a sole source situation. That is not ideal by any stretch. Another thing you have to ask yourself, or we have to ask ourselves, existing revenue dependencies, are they significant? So does the organization that we're seeking a sole source with, are they providing a service or a good that is so important to our revenue collection that we're really nervous about doing anything else? Another one, cost avoidance opportunities. Are we avoiding the cost or significant costs by sticking with an existing vendor? Another one. And then complexity or uniqueness of good or service. And you can see a lot of these are overlapping, but they're all considerations that have to come into play. Wanted to remind everybody just about the back office system timeline, because it comes into play more and more frequently when we're talking about all of our procurements. All the different vendor relationships we have are increasingly called into question when we're thinking about this timeline. We want to have a new system in place by the end of 2014, and there are certain parts of our existing system that we're pretty nervous about moving around or tinkering with until we have something new in place. We're nervous because of revenue, we're nervous because of potential costs, we're just nervous. And we're looking to protect, you know, we're looking to protect the revenues that we have and the customer service capacity that we have. Which then brings us to a very similar slide, but you'll see some different colors on it. The things in red are things that could be potential sole source contracts in the future, and the things that are circled are sole sources that we are bringing this month. So just starting with this month, because it's the most interesting, and then we'll expand upon that in a moment. In the other contracts category there at the bottom, you'll see a circle around web self-service and registered owner vehicle data. I mean, those sound very dry and boring, but I can, you know, trust me, as an ops person, these are very exciting and interesting and meaningful. So the web self-service provider today is Unisys. And Unisys, over a number of years, has built a very heavily customized and very complex data link to our existing back office system that allows people to access their accounts, to make payments, to look at, you know, view images online, all of that stuff. And this is the sole source that was brought to the finance committee yesterday, and it will show up at the board on the agenda for approval. The second item there is what we will talk about today, which is much more customer focused, which is the registered owner of vehicle data. So when somebody violates, and we have a picture of their plate, if it's an Illinois plate, we go to our Secretary of State, we pay a small fee that's part of an intergovernmental agreement, and they send us the registered owner data. If it's from out of state, we have to go through a third party. I mean, we don't have 50 different data feeds from around the United States. We go to a third party provider that collects all of this registered owner data from all the different DMVs, cleanses it, reorganizes it, relabels it, does all this stuff to it, and then sends it back to us. Now, that third-party provider does it differently for each one of the organizations that they work with, because each one of our systems, for the most part, are pretty customized. So today we work with a provider called LES, Law Enforcement Services. They're a small company, they're out of New York State, and over a number of years now, we have worked with them to develop and use a very customized interface where they send us this data. And as we talk about on the next slide, it's going to be something that we would like to stick with until we have a new system, because we're so nervous about pulling it out. We've got a lot of out-of-state drivers, and we need their registered owner data, and we don't want to mess with it and go for weeks, months, whatever it might be, if something didn't go well. What you see above is kind of a more forward-looking view, and it's something that we're trying to work through right now with doing a lot of research on, because we're not quite sure how all of this will unfold. But in the lane contracts box on the top left, you'll see two things that are in red. One is the lane controller software. That's the software we have at the lanes that collects the transactions and then packages them to send to our back office. And another one are the patents that we discussed. So there are certain patents that, like the loops in the pavement, for instance, are a heavily patented item. And if we were to move to a different vendor for lanes, we wouldn't want to pull out our loops. We wouldn't want to put them in a different way. We might have to pay for the patents just to keep using what we've got or something like that. We're not quite sure, but we're figuring it out, and we want to give everybody kind of a heads up. Same goes for that lane controller software. Maybe it's custom developed, and maybe it's something that can be maintained by a party that didn't develop it. Maybe it's something that we could replace. We're not really sure. Not a lot of tollways have been in the position of having to do this quite yet, but we're researching our options, potential sole source. The other thing here, this ETC stuff, I know we have a big contract with them today for the back office. They won't be running it in the future, but we will have to keep what we have today up and running for a while on a very limited basis with very limited support services, and that's, again, a potential sole source that we would have to talk about in the future. So that's really just a tee up, a sense for this committee of the procurement world we might be looking at or facing, kind of the horizon. I don't know if there are any questions. It's a lot of detail, and I always hate to force people into the weeds like this, but we wanted to at least get across the point that we're not winging it, and we're not bringing sole sources because it's easy. We're trying to be thoughtful about it, and we're trying to do it strategically. And
we also wanted to give a heads up that, as we make this transition, we will periodically see these, right?
Yeah.
Then one other thing to add, if I may, on those other contracts too that Shauna just referenced, the one I presented yesterday was Unisys. You know, we have millions of dollars invested in this infrastructure, and you know, it doesn't make any sense to throw it out the window and repurchase all of it just for a couple, 2-3 years until the new back office procurement is implemented. Because eventually that's going to go away, right? And this is just a bridge to get us there. And similar to the procurement that you're going through with the LES one that you're going to present today, it's my understanding there's a huge investment if we were to change out vendors right now just for that 3-year period.
Yeah.
I heard it was like a $300,000 or more just to make the change.
Yeah, that's actually a nice segue. This is the next slide, and there's an item summary too. Talks about what we'd like to bring to vote today for procurement, which is a sole source with law enforcement services, LES. There is a hearing scheduled for May 22nd, and we're anticipating a contract term of 3 years. The anticipated cost is about $400,000 a year, which works out to $1.2 million. There are 3 years. The main considerations we have here are the risk of establishing a new complex and heavily customized integration point when we have about $11 million of annual revenue recovery at risk every year. That's what service makes possible for us. To John's point, the cost of integrating with a new vendor, a new LES type vendor to our current system, which is going to sunset in approximately 2 years anyway, would be an estimated $300,000. And then, kind of similar to what has been discussed for the web functionality, it's a uniquely risky integration point. There are things, for example, we integrate with the collection agencies and we send data back and forth every day at least once. And it's not that it was super easy to establish those integration points. But they are not super complex, and they're not scary. We could work with other collection vendors, and we can establish those integration points even in an interim environment without a ton of risk. We don't feel that way about this. This is an integration point that is uncommonly complex and customized. So then the question comes here, can I get to the item summary? Yeah.
Shauna, did you...
Thank you, yeah.
Did you already, in your intro comments, so the directors understand, we talk about in the first bullet, a hearing being scheduled? I don't know, Director Reddick may already be well aware of what that is. If you are, just move past it, but I wanted to make sure we had a comfort level for the two of you.
I know that it's on May 22nd.
Who it's before,
right?
Sort of how that would go, I don't know if the director...
So the chief procurement officer in Springfield, who has ultimate procurement authority for all the agencies under his jurisdiction, you know, every sole source contract that's entered into, he has to approve. And, you know, because of some relief that the governor legislation he signed into law last, I believe, September, you know, we're not required to have a hearing for every sole source transaction. Some of the more complex sole sources, you know, they tend to have a hearing. This may be one of them, because it's a little bit different. It's the first time. It's a three-year. The chief procurement officer in Springfield, he doesn't like to have sole sources longer than a year. Obviously, if it's justified and it makes the right business sense, he'll generally approve it. But so, to David's point, you know, Shauna's going to present this as a three-year sole source, which I support and which our state purchasing officer supports. But it still has to pass muster with the CPO in Springfield, so there's an outside chance that he could take this down to a two-year term or even possibly a one-year term. So it's important to know.
In that case, does it have to come back to the board for that approval, or how does that...
That's the approval that Shauna would be seeking today, is that it would be a three-year sole source subject to the results of this hearing. So if it gets docked down to 2 years or 1 year, you would still...
We'd probably send that information as an informational item then. Since you already, let's say if you authorize, if the board authorizes a three-year term, and let's just say the CPO decides to take 2 years, you know, we'll definitely notify you of that, of that change. And then...
From the full board standpoint, not the committee, but for the full board of directors, you will have your... response from the CPO prior to the full board vote, or not necessarily?
We probably won't. We're encouraging him to get us a response before the full board, so it's clear at the meeting. But you know, we've seen him take a week and a half to 2 weeks in some circumstances to either approve it or, you know, lower the term.
Okay. So depending on how that situation sits at the time of the full board, we'll give it some thought whether we would do a resolution that provides flexibility or defers or whatever makes sense then for you.
And David, that's the same, you know, same issue really with the Unisys one that I presented yesterday, right? Because there's a sole source hearing is the same day, May 22nd. So
yeah, you get a busy day on the 22nd.
Yes.
Today.
Yes. And one other thing to note in regards to Unisys and this LES one is that, you know, let's say if the back office procurement is implemented sooner, all of our contracts have kind of termination for convenience clauses in them, so this may not be a true three-year term.
Right.
Okay. Bearing on the size of caution. There's one more thing I'd like to point out about this LES contract. It is part, when I talked earlier, under a different context, about that consolidated customer service contract with TransCorp, where we've worked over the course of almost 2 years now to pull that apart into four different pieces that are now sitting with state use vendors. This is part of that. The LES contract was rolled up to TransCorp when all of this was established. And it's kind of this this leftover piece that we're, for all the reasons just mentioned, that we would like to keep as it is for the moment and then move to something more competitive when we have a new back office. So then, I don't know if we can go to the item summary. I finally found it on my screen with John's help.
Go back to the agenda.
I went to the agenda, and I scrolled down the agenda.
Is there an easier way to do that?
That's
what I did, whatever.
Okay. I'm just glad I was sitting next to somebody to help me.
Get another quick link or something.
So the item summary here goes over a lot of what was just talked about, and you can see that we are requesting approval to award a three-year sole source contract for out-of-state license plate retrieval services, and that is pending the sole source hearing on May 22nd. the amount is in $1.2 million to cover the 3 years. That's $400,000 per year.
Question? No, I'll take a motion.
I move.
I'll second it. Is there any questions? Do we need a roll call on this if it has to go to the board?
Do you move it to the full board?
Yeah. The motion is to move it to the full board with recommendation from the committee. All those in favor signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, so that does move to the full board.
Makes sense.
All right.
Thanks for working through it with us.
All right. Unfinished business. What could possibly be unfinished?
Is everyone exhausted now? Sorry.
Good job, sir.
We do have one item in new business.
All right. What do we got?
We've got a boy of 7 pounds and 9 ounces.
Whoa. Yay.
7 pounds and 9 ounces.
Jeffrey, what?
We do not have a name yet.
I will text her my proposal. Very good news. Awesome. Mom and baby, everybody's doing well?
Everyone's doing well.
Great.
Excellent. Got one picture.
All right.
Oh, hey. He's got a better
one. All right. So that, is there any other new business? Is there anything for executive session? All right. Take a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All those in favor signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much. We stand adjourned.